come across them at all, then the Ten Commandments, as you find them in Exodus chapter 20, are almost always drastically misunderstood. So famous are they, of course, that they've built their phraseology into our culture. People talk about Ten Commandments, and very often these days they don't mean by that the Ten Commandments that we find here in Exodus. There are the Ten Commandments of politics, or the Ten Commandments of social responsibility, or the Ten Commandments of ecology, or of green issues, the first of which is to make sure that you don't use CFC-unfriendly aerosols, and the second of which that you make sure you recycle your rubbish, and so on. But as we've seen in these past few weeks, before the Harvest Thanksgiving service last week, these Ten Commandments were given in a particular context, and it's vital that we grasp the context so that we understand what it is we're about to jump into and spend the next few Sunday mornings in, and therefore how they apply to us. Because the question is not, what do they mean to you and me? The question is, what does God intend here? And therefore, how does it apply? That's the way we have always to deal with the Bible, and context is always key. The Ten Commandments are given, as you'll see if you cast your eye across the Bible, I hope, which is in front of you. They're given to a people whom God has already redeemed. We've already been through the exercise of this people whom God loves. Already he's brought them out of slavery in Egypt, as he says just at the beginning of chapter 20. Already he has been and proved himself to them to be the God who loves them and who keeps his promises of love to them. He is the God who is the Lord, the capital, as you'll see there, chapter 2 and verse 1. Chapter 20, verse 2. L, capital O, capital R, capital D. This is Yahweh. This is the God who makes and keeps his promises. The God who means the covenants that he says, and who has kept them to this people, the children of Abraham. This is the God who loves his people and brought them, as he says, there out of the land of slavery. We saw 2 weeks ago that these 10 words, as Moses later calls them, were given as God's special instructions, therefore, to a people who he has rescued, so that they may enjoy the gracious liberty of his rescue. This is never intended. I hope nobody here understands them like this. But these are never intended to be a ladder to climb up to somehow be good enough for God. Down the centuries and across the cultures, the Ten Commandments of God here in Exodus 20 have been understood in that way. And if they're understood in that way, they're understood wrong. Because the context doesn't allow it, and the Bible all the way through denies that possibility. And they've been given to the people he has rescued on the basis, as he says there, of his being the Lord. Everything else runs from this. He introduces them with that important phrase. I'm not going to apologize for laboring it, because it's vital we get it. I am the Lord, your God. Everything else I have to say from here on runs from that point. My being the Lord means that I am the rescuing, promise-keeping, covenant-keeping God. I am the Lord. Everything I've got to say to you must be understood in that context, and that I am the one who brought you out of slavery. And the very first thing he wants them to grasp, as having introduced himself in that way, is verse 3, the first commandment, that there is one Lord. That's the first point as well. One Lord. After all he's done for them and who he is, I guess it's no surprise then that that's going to be the very first commandment. The first one they need to think about and remember, and the priority for everything else that comes. You shall have no other gods before me. I said with the children that we tend always to write down the most important things first, or the things that everything else must run in the context of. I don't know whether the other adults here have the same experience as me, but if you go into the supermarket for after one particular thing, undoubtedly, invariably, I always at least, manage to come out with 20 different things. But you know, if you go in for milk, over and above everything else you buy, you've got to buy milk, don't you? Because that's the number one reason why you went in there. You may happen to pick up meat and bread and vegetables and so on as well, but that's the reason you went in there. We tend to put in our thinking and on our lists the thing that everything else runs from first. So here, the rest of these commandments make no sense at all were it not for the first one. You shall have no other gods before me. Remember, these people in this desert, around this mountain, have come from a culture in which there were a whole range of so-called gods. They have spent, as a culture, 400 years living in Egypt. And in Egypt, there's a whole raft of gods. You only need to go to the British Museum to learn about some of the gods that are worshipped in Egypt. Most of us will know about the pyramids, the worship of Ra, the sun god, where somehow the tombs of the dead are pointing up to heaven, where the sun god is, so they believe. They worshipped Pharaoh, the god king, and he could be manifested both in snakes and in cats and in bulls and so on. They worshipped cats. They worshipped a whole cacophony of different gods. I'm told that there are rats in Egypt that communicate some kind of deity and so on. Egypt, where they had come from, was what we would now call, and actually now live in, a pluralistic or even a multi-faith society. How about that? These people knew what it was to live in a multi-faith society, just like you and I do. And in addition to all of that, the peoples around them in this desert scene where they're standing at the moment at Mount Sinai, you've got the Amalekites with their god, the Canaanites they're going to, the Ammonites and so on. And you had gods with varying names like Baal and Molech, as is mentioned elsewhere in Scripture, the detestable god of the people of Ammon. You've got Asherah, the goddess of fertility, and so on and so on. They knew what it was to live in a culture where people worshipped everything. And the great temptation would be to understand that these other gods, Baal and Molech and Ra and so on, somehow had some kind of validity of some kind. And that somehow, as they moved around in the different cultures in which they lived and moved around the land, so somehow there was a need to appease the little local ancestral tribal deities as well as your own. Sure, the Lord is our God, but then if we walk through into the land of the Canaanites, well, we've somehow got to appease Baal as well, haven't we? Could easily come to thinking. But the Lord makes it clear with this very first commandment. Bearing in mind the commandments are but the response that God requires of the people whom he loves. God makes it clear that that simply isn't to be done at all. For when he says there in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. It isn't that he wants his people somehow to put him first and the others second or third or whatever. There is not, as in Greek mythology, a kind of top god with all the other minority deities that come underneath. It's not like you have the Lord there and then Baal is somewhere down there, Molech somewhere down here, and Pharaoh is somewhere over here. It isn't never intended to be like that. God wants these people to understand, and he builds it into the first commandment with a peculiar phraseology he uses. Tell me, if you wanted to understand the kind of pyramidal seniority structure, then you probably wouldn't introduce it by saying no other bosses before me, would you? Imagine you were working in a company and you wanted all the subordinates to understand that you were the first one. Well, you would phrase it a little differently, wouldn't you? You would say, nobody else is over me, wouldn't you? Or I am the top dog, or something like that. He uses this phrase before me, because it's actually the same phrase that you get in several different places in the Bible. And it means something quite specific. In fact, directly translated, some of you I know are using the ESV. I'd be interested to know if somebody felt like calling out precisely what verse 3 says in the ESV. Does it say just before me? besides me. Okay, that's good. Directly translated, it actually has, somebody else got the New American Standard. It's different again, isn't it? It's the same, is it? Okay, all right. Well, directly translated, it actually means upon me, or to me, or at my face. Let me give you an example. Turn to Genesis chapter 11 for a minute. You see the same phrase. Page 9 and verse 28. Don't worry if you don't want to look this up, but do listen while I just read it out. This is talking of an account of different nations, but I choose it because it illustrates this particular linguistic point rather well. And it says in verse 28 of somebody or other, Abraham, while his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans in the land of his birth. Another translation gets it more correctly and says, and Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldeans. That phrase, in the presence of, is exactly the same one as we find here in Exodus chapter 20. It means before the face of. There are other examples that amount to the same thing. And the point that God is making to the people is this. They are to have no other gods in the presence of the Lord. No other gods before his face. In other words, you are not to treat anything else as God. As one commentator puts it, No other religious loyalty is permitted. And to our Western ears, that might sound rather obvious. But you know, in reality, it is a problem elsewhere in the world. Most of us will know Irving Steggles, who used to be here in Chippenham, and who now and who went to work in South Africa, to pastor a church in South Africa. I remember when Irving first went out there to Durban, having a conversation about the different issues that he was dealing with in the church and different people that he was relating to. I remember him telling me that one of the greatest problems was that of syncretism, which is the mixing of two religious belief systems, which is very common in a variety of different places in the world. What dominated the thinking of some of the Christians who on the one hand would be in church and would be singing hymns and would be reading their Bibles and saying their prayer and so on and so forth, that they would do that on Sundays and maybe some other times during the rest of the week. But at the same time, they had an awareness of ancestral religion, maybe in the particular case he was giving, of ancestor worship. And it meant that when it came to crises moments in their lives, or family funerals, or family weddings, or the dedication of a job, or whatever it was, then somehow they would both pray to and serve the Lord, and yet somehow also take notice of and pay homage to the ancestral gods that they also had to appease. And here were people who you and I would regard as Christians, and the Bible would call Christians, but who at the same time have an awareness of something else that they had to worship. That's exactly the sort of thing that God is talking about here. He says to the people whom he has rescued that that simply cannot be. In our own Western culture, it is even more of a problem than that, because it's so subtle. You see, in our own Western culture, I've heard it on the radio even this week, you will sometimes hear people say that there is some validity to all religions. And indeed, that all religions are somehow reaching up the same mountain, but a mountain from different sides. And we may call that mountain God or the Lord, but the Muslim may call that mountain Allah or something similar. And the Hindu may call it Shiva. And the Buddhist, who doesn't believe in God at all, knows that there is some kind of deity and doesn't know what to call it at all. And so on and so forth. You see the point? The very first commandment, however, does not leave that possibility open. Because the very basis on which the commandment is given is that he is the Lord. Yahweh, the covenant-keeping, promise-keeping God. And if there were any other ways to get to him that were valid, then why would the Lord have dismissed those other ways out of hand and quite sternly forbidden any other route up the mountain? Indeed, if there were other ways to get to God, why, when you go back to the plagues that we looked at a month or three ago, why was God making small in the plagues as we looked at the sun god or Pharaoh or rats or whatever? There are no other gods. That's the answer why. These people were to have one Lord, because there is only one Lord. And it may not be very palatable for our politically correct sensitivities, but the Bible does not leave room for there to be any other deity. The message of the first commandment is one Lord and no rivals. That's the point that they've got to grasp. One Lord and no rivals. Think about our culture for a moment and the way that actually might work out. It's not very palatable, is it, to be one of those apparently intolerant people who insists that the Bible is correct and that there is only one God. And it doesn't sit well with our culture and with the permissive society in which we live. I'm certain, however, that it does not mean that we are to be those who drive out others or who punish others or who despise others who believe in other gods. But what it does mean is that we must keep our own thinking clear. What is the correct response of these people in this desert place to the God who loves them and has rescued them? The very first response is that they must grasp there is only one God. And the second point, the second commandment, builds on exactly that. Not only is there one Lord and no rivals, but the second commandment, verses 4 to 6, gives the message that there is one Lord and no idols either. Verse 4, let's pick up the story. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. If you've been with us for some months now, then I guess you'll already know that the primary point that's being made here, that the knowledge, and specifically here the worship of God, must be according to his word. These people have been relating to God for some months, and of course Moses for even longer than them. And in all of that time, right from the burning bush where there was fire, right into Egypt with the plagues and so on and so forth, right the way through the Red Sea as God opened the path for them, on into the desert and all the way here to Mount Sinai, the only manifestation of any kind that they have had of God's presence has been in the one thing that it would be impossible for them ever to model, which is a pillar of cloud or fire, however you want to phrase it. There's never been an image for them to grasp hold of. There's never been anything that they can look at and say, that's what God looks like. That's the picture we've got to try and remember. They couldn't bring a photograph. They couldn't get a sketch artist. There's nothing that they could say, it's that we must worship. What they have encountered, and as he delivers the commands to them, is the only thing that they've really encountered, is his voice. That is to say, is his word. And that is not an accident. You see, the other gods we've already mentioned were worshipped with the assistance, if you will call it that, of idols. Baal had some kind of model or other. We're not exactly clear on what it was. You read elsewhere in the Old Testament of Dagon, where the Philistines had a kind of idol in a temple that they used to offer things to. And it's quite interesting in that story, if you think about it, in 1 Kings 20, something like that, where Dagon ends up, the idol ends up bowing before the only physical thing that may be taken to represent God's presence, which is the Ark of the Covenant, which we're going to come on to later on in Exodus. Asherah had a pole that they could worship her through, and so on and so forth. Having established that they're only to worship him because there are no other gods, even the worship of the Lord is not somehow to involve the use of idols. But that doesn't seem fair, does it? I mean, come on. You might ask, after all, idols surely aid worship. If you have something to visualize, it's much easier to be able to relate to, isn't it? Think for a moment of our own situation here. Couldn't it be argued by somebody that if somehow when we came to gather together as a church, if there was some kind of figure, some kind of model, some kind of face that we could kind of get our minds around, wouldn't it be easier to worship? As you go home and worship at home in our families and maybe on our own sometimes, wouldn't it be easier if we could somehow have something to picture? People do that, don't they? That was exactly the same argument used by the Roman Catholic Church when the Roman Empire fell in the 5th century after Christ. Because they suddenly found themselves faced with a lot of empty pagan temples that they could grab and use for so-called Christian gatherings. And what was the very first thing they did? They went in there, and of course, on the inside of pagan temples from the Roman Empire, what would you have? You'd have pictures and idols of the Roman gods. So very quickly they found the top god, and he was a sort of bearded figure with longish hair, and they said, well, we're no longer going to call that picture Zeus, we're going to call that picture Jesus, because it will help everybody in their worship. And there was a female figure as well, actually Isis, the god of Roman fertility, the goddess of Roman fertility. Hey, let's not call her Isis, because there's no such a thing as Roman pagan deities anymore. Let's call her Mary. And we'll bow down to that and we'll worship that, because it will aid our worship after all. And all these pagan peoples will have, who are so stupid that they can't listen to words, will somehow be able to visualize God more easily. Anything that apparently aids worship in this way is open to misuse. That's the problem, as I've just illustrated. Think for a moment of what happened, if you have any awareness of the rest of what's going on in the New Testament. Just a few months, or maybe a few years, after this incident here in Exodus 20, during the 40-year wanderings in the desert, the people entered into, at the end of the book of Exodus, on one occasion, to clarify their trust in God, they were rescued from a terrible judgment by having to look at the symbol of a snake on a pole. And what happens? The snake's coming to the camp and biting them, and God says, look, Moses, make a bronze serpent, put it on a pole, everybody that looks to the serpent, and actually in practice, everybody who looks to my rescue will be saved. And you find that the people were looking, and they were looking to God's rescuer and being saved. Jesus takes that incident and in John chapter 3 reinterprets it to point to him, but on this particular point, the people were being saved by staring at a snake. You'll find the account, don't look for it now, in Numbers chapter 21. And many are saved, and the figure disappears from view until it reappears some 700 years later in the reign of King Hezekiah of Judah. Just turn it up with me, because what it has to say there is very interesting. You'll find the account in 2 Kings chapter 18. Page 274, if you're using one of the Bibles from the back. Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, verse 2, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces, here's the point, the bronze snake that Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. 700 years later, Hezekiah finally smashes the thing to pieces. 700 years. Think of, if you've knowledge of the Bible history, think of what had happened in those 700 years. And that may sound very far-fetched, and the skeptic may say, oh, surely nobody holds on to idols and things like that that long. But if you go, you know, to various outposts now of the Catholic Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church, you will find people worshipping there various pictures of saints. Or indeed, it's said that they worship and so on little bits of the cross. In fact, somebody has estimated that if you put together all the little bits of wood that apparently are bits of the cross, then and venerated as such, then you would not, in fact, have enough to make a cross. You'd have enough to make a battleship. Symbolism in worship, idolatry in worship, though it sounds so plausible, says God, just cannot be. Verse 5 of Exodus 20. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, punishing the sins of the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. We're going to deal in a moment with the part about punishing children, which sounds so awful. We'll come to that in a minute. But God gives his reason for them not making for themselves any idol of any kind, of anything, because he is a jealous God. What has jealousy got to do with them making idols? Well, the answer is simply this. That an idol, any form, any visual image of God, always demeans God and robs him of his glory. Think for a moment who it is we're talking about. The God of the universe, who made all things and sustains all things and knows all things. This is the God who placed the stars in space. This is the God who formed the earth out of nothing, who breathed life into the first people, who is the one that keeps the world turning and makes the sun shining. This is the God who is beyond our comprehension, that he knows everything. He knows every thought going through every one of our brains right now, even the ones you're not aware of. How about that? He's the one who knows how many hairs are on each of our heads. Do you know how many hairs are on your head? Maybe to some I should ask, do you know how many hairs are not on your head? God knows everything, can do everything, sustains everything. How can you ever paint a picture or form an image that would represent that? Paul writes to the Christians at Rome in Romans chapter 1. And in Romans chapter 1, he speaks of people who demean God in exactly that way. You may like to turn it up if you'd like to. It's page 793, but don't worry if not. And Paul says there that the wrath of God is being verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For, says Paul, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles and so on. You see, as soon as you exchange what God has revealed about himself for something he has created, whatever image you use, you rob God of his glory. You imagine for a moment something that would correctly display God. So what are we going to worship? A picture of a person? You might say Jesus. We'll come to him in a second. But a strong animal? But that can never talk about the God who made the stars. How about the picture of the sun? That would surely do it, wouldn't it? But actually, if you know anything about astronomy, then you'll know that the sun is just a very kind of average star. about middle age, not kind of really going anywhere, not kind of really doing anything, and the only thing that's going for it is the fact that it's the third planet out from its center. It's called the Earth, on which we live, on which the Son of God visited. Well, how about the biggest star then? Well, which one is that? Well, how about a black hole then? Oh yeah, how are you going to paint a picture of that? How about a galaxy? How about the universe? Hey, how about stopping the complication and just doing what God says? That's the answer. The Lord will only be worshipped in the way He prescribes and according to His word. As we've seen it before, otherwise the worship of God will become something of a man-made potluck where everybody just makes it up and does as they see fit. No idols. One Lord, no rivals. One Lord, no idols. For not only is such worship demeaning, it is also damaging. Which brings us to verses 5 and 6. Why no idols? Because He is a jealous God who will not have His glory demeaned. And because He says, I am the Lord your God, I'm a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now there is a part of all of us that reads that verse and says, ouch, isn't there? I wish that wasn't in my Bible. Because somehow the God who I love and who has shown Himself, as He put it in chapter 19, to love His people so much, He carried them, as He says, on eagle's wings from the land of slavery to Himself. The God who is so loving, so caring, so careful, so glorious, has just kind of embarrassed me by talking about punishing kids for things their dads have done. How could God be so vindictive as to make children suffer for what their parents have done? That surely cannot be right. But look again at the context to understand what's going on here. It is not that the children bear the direct retributive justice for their parents' sins. Other passages in the Bible deny that. 2 Chronicles 25 says, fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin. I read from that example of Hezekiah, who went around smashing up all the idol things in Israel. And not least did he smash up the snake god thing, Nehushtan, that they'd been worshipping right the way through Moses' time for 400 years. Who was Hezekiah's dad? Ahaz. Who was Ahaz's dad? You don't need to trace it back very far before you find the most terrible people involved. It's not that Hezekiah has blown out God because of something his dad did. No, rather that God rejected Hezekiah. There are consequences for our actions. That is the point. As God delivers these Ten Commandments to His people, He wants them to know that there are consequences for actions. With this point of idolatry, if you disobey the Lord and worship an idol, you demean the Lord. That's clear. And if you demean the Lord in your own eyes, you will do so in your children's eyes, and their children's eyes, and their children, and so on. The consequences of your actions now, says God, will be carried over into your succeeding generations. Think how that works. People who ignore God and disobey Him and aren't interested in Him are people who, the grace of God steps in here, but it are people who in a human sense bear children who ignore God and disobey Him and so on. And if you're a Christian today, one of God's people, and you love your own children or love other people's children whom you know and long for them to know God in the same way as you do, then think primarily, says God, that how you know me, how you respond to me, how you worship me, how you long for me, has a direct effect on your children's attitudes to me as well. the consequences of your actions now will be carried over into succeeding generations. Likewise, if the people whom God has rescued love him and respond rightly to him now, then they will know his love and live in relationship with him, and much more likely will their children, their children's children, and so on. Though I understand completely, and so does God, the providence and sovereignty. His point is, if you love the succeeding generations, your children or someone else's, then you will want them to know the Lord in his glory. So treat him as he says. But someone may argue that the argument is all very clear about one Lord, no rivals, and one Lord, no idols, and no form, and nothing to visualize, and so on. But surely someone may argue that sending the Lord Jesus disclosed, God disclosed himself in just such terms that we can understand. I can't understand the God of all glory, but I can understand a baby in a manger. I can't understand the God of all glory, but I can understand a man being nailed to a cross. Doesn't the whole thing fall apart there? I may not know what his face looked like, but I can understand what a human being looks like. But what does the New Testament have to say on that point? Very briefly. John chapter 1. Page 748. God wants us to worship him, to know him, to love him, to honor him with what he has revealed, and not what our mind's eyes can remember or our pictures can paint. So how does he introduce Christ to us? In the beginning was, what does it say? What do you expect it to say at this point? The man? No. The baby? The person? In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. Look down to verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Well, did they see his glory? Well, look, for example, at the mountain of transfiguration, Matthew chapter 17. And what happened on the mountain of transfiguration? As there was a visual image for these people to remember, verse 2, page 694. Jesus is on a mountain with three particular disciples, James, Peter, and John. And there, verse 2 tells us, he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Though how on earth you'd draw a picture of any of that stuff, I've no idea. And then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus, and Peter said, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, what? This is my beloved son, look at him. This is my beloved son, make a model of him, draw him, take a picture. Remember? No. This is my beloved son, whom I love, with him I am well pleased. Listen to him. Here's the point. God is worshipped according to what he reveals, and that is according to his word. Point is made here again. It's not what Jesus looked like that made the difference, that displayed his glory, but it's what he said, and ultimately what he did. So Philippians 2, don't bother to turn for it, most of us will know it well. If you do want to turn to it, Philippians 2 and verse 6. Speaking of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, and taking the very nature, the very form of a servant. So if you want to know what God looks like, there's no point exactly in having a picture, because that picture's only the form of a servant anyway. It's the God who is contracted to a span, who has incomprehensibly been made man, not the other way around. Taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. The right response for the people of God to the love of God is to know one Lord and one Lord alone. And the problem, you see, is that just such commandments as these, though they are the right response, still the right response for the rescued people of God to God, they proved then impossible to fulfill. We may understand what and why and how, but neither the people then nor we now can do, at least on the inside. And that is why Jesus came to make that stoop. That is why he had to take on the nature and the form of a servant and be made in human likeness. Because our hearts do stray to other gods. He makes clear that we should worship him alone, and came to die on a cross to take the punishment for those times we don't. Because idolatry is somehow part of our broken, fallen nature. We do visualize, though we know it's wrong. He came, in very nature God, to take the punishment on that cross that we deserve. We have much to thank God for, and much to honour him with. And we're going to see the rest, in the rest of Exodus 20, and see what Jesus has to say about it all in the New Testament in Matthew 5 tonight.